Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Generations. This is Kevin Swanson, Executive Director of Christian Home Educators, a pastor, but I'm also a father of five, and that's why I'm on the air with you today. We look at the culture through the eyes of a biblical worldview and through the eyes of fathers, because we happen to be fathers here on this program. But today we have Ken Myers. He's going to be joining us in just a moment, author of All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes, but first a commentary. I am a frustrated man, Dave. I am a frustrated man, and I'll tell you why. It's because ever since Francis Schaeffer showed up, 30, 40 years ago, and said, hey, guys, humanism has won. Humanism has won. The game is over. The humanism is making its victory laps around the tomb of Christianity. The Christian faith is dead. We have no impact whatsoever on the culture. Ever since that point, of course, Christians ran into the culture, as I did. Back in the 80s and 90s, I ran into the culture and tried to have an impact on the culture. But after 25 years of this, I'm just not sure that Christians' involvement in the culture has really done that much. I mean, do we really think that the Christian heavy metal band Payable on Death and the exorcism of Emily Rose and the Christian art forms and the cultural approaches we have taken really have what it takes to stand contra mundum and really make an impact on things like, you know, the way people think and the way people live, for example? I don't think we do. What do you think, Dave?
Well, I think you're talking about leading a culture. Right now, Christian culture is following a culture. It is copying the forms of the secular world. Of course we're going to be secular.
We're borrowing the same forms. You know, you go into a cannibalistic culture and you borrow all the forms of the cannibals. You assume that the cannibals' art forms are the best ways to convey your worldview. Dave, it just doesn't work out that way. Let me give you an illustration. You know, the pagans out there love to illustrate their rebellion and hatred towards others by the lifting of the middle finger in the air. All right, have you seen this ritual before?
You're number one.
Yes, it's the lifting of the middle finger in the air. Perhaps some of our listeners are familiar with this particular ritual that the pagans use. It's an obscene gesture that conveys a significant message of disrespect towards others. All right? Enough said. Now, this is only a cultural form. And really, there's nothing inherently sinful about lifting your middle finger in the air, Dave. I mean, God made this finger as well as this one and this one. God made the middle finger, and we can be grateful for our middle fingers. But let's suppose that Christians, let's take a Christian youth group. Let's say that they began the practice of raising their middle fingers in the air during their praise and worship time. Okay? Just sort of, you know, praise Jesus. Everybody will get their middle fingers in the air, praise Jesus, this sort of thing. It should be, I think, intuitively obvious, Dave, that even though this may be an effort to be relevant to the surrounding culture, and maybe it lacks a little in creativity, but still, there seems to be something wrong with this. They may feel like they have used the form with a pure and a simple heart that has sanctified the form, but there's still something incongruous between the method and the message. Does that make sense? I mean, praising Jesus and lifting the middle finger in the air. The problem is you have dragged the cultural form from the pagans into a praise and worship service for Jesus. And it just, narrow the two shall meet. Well, we're going to talk, folks, a little bit more on Christians involved in culture in just a moment. Ken Myers, author of All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes, next on Generations. Stay with us. Folks, welcome back to Generations. Kevin Swanson here with you. And today with us on the air is Ken Myers. For 8 years, Ken produced and edited programs for Morning Edition and All Things Considered on National Public Radio. He's author of the book on Christians and popular culture called All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes. I heartily recommend the book. And he now produces a regular audio program available through MarsHillAudio.org on the web. Welcome, Ken Myers, to Generations.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Now, Ken, you've been involved in cultural activities for quite some time, since the 1970s. You've been involved with National Public Radio and other efforts. You're now doing your own Christian cultural radio program. And you do critique pop culture. In fact, the book All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes involves a critique of pop culture. How did you come to that critique?
I grew up in a conservative Christian family and church, and was interested in the issues of how the church related to culture from an early age. When I was in high school, I got involved in music of various types, pop music as well as classical music. When I was in college, I ended up majoring in film studies, in part because I thought film was such an influential cultural form that I wanted to understand it better as a Christian, but also as someone who loved creative expression. And I began to be really aware when I was in college of how the forms that communicate to us, the forms of media particularly television and film, but also radio and music, convey a kind of implicit assumptions about reality, that the way we believe, the way we think, and the way we feel about life is often communicated to us in pretty subtle ways through the structures of culture. And then in the late 80s, I was asked actually to write that book. I wrote it on invitation as part of a series that was being published by that publisher. And they asked me to write a book on popular culture, and I originally set out to write a book that would look at a number of varieties or forms of popular culture, like romance novels or Western movies or crime stories or something like that, and try to look at ways Christians might interpret those particular genres or forms. But I began to realize that the very existence of something that we call popular culture was really something Christians needed to attend to. It hasn't always been the case that our cultural experience was delivered to us by strangers through mass media. So my interest is, how does it change our family life? How does it change our church life? How does it change our perception of reality? That much of our time is spent consuming mass media products produced by distant strangers.
You know, I think that popular culture has much more influence on people than they like to think. Probably MTV has more influence on the way your average church attender behaves than the sermons preached from the pulpit.
Yeah, back in the 80s, a book was written called Amusing Ourselves to Death by a man named Neil Postman, and that book actually influenced me a lot in what I wrote. Postman basically looked at how the fact that we're surrounded by images more than words, images more than arguments, more than statements of truth, affects our perception of the very nature of truth. So a lot of people say, well, we live in a relativistic age, that is, people aren't concerned with absolute truth or absolute goodness. Well, I'm convinced that one of the reasons is because the forms of communication that are most dominant in our experience are formally indifferent to truth. That is, an image can't be true or false. it's just kind of there in that way. Now, it could be misrepresenting reality in some way, but we don't really say it's false. False and true are terms that we apply to statements, to verbal statements. And look at Time magazine, say, 40 years ago, and see how few pictures there were. Or even look at network newscasts from 40 years ago. The emphasis now is on the image, not the verbal content. Now, that has a profound effect on our lives. It has a profound effect on the way we think we ought to think, the way we feel we ought to feel. And those things are often not attended to by Christians. Christians often, understandably, focus on the content. We focus on the words, particularly content that it might be sexual or might be blasphemous in some way. And part of my concern in writing that book, and a concern I continue to have, though these many years later, is that we really need to pay attention to how the forms of popular culture affect our thinking, but also affect the deep assumptions that we have about the way we ought to live.
Ken, one of the best contributions of your book is your distinction you draw between folk culture, high culture, and pop culture. Why don't you describe that and then show why folk culture and high culture have something better to recommend to us than the modern pop culture would?
That was a device I stumbled on as I was thinking about how to explain the difference of cultural experience for those of us who grow up surrounded by what we call popular culture, and trying to figure, well, how were things different? For most of human history, folk culture is a term that is used to describe a setting in which most of the stories we know, most of the music we know, most of the cultural experiences that we have are the product of a community that has a shared set of convictions, that has a common history and a shared way of life. So we might be familiar with folk music or folk dances or folk tales as kind of traditional, and often we regard them as rather primitive, undeveloped sorts of modes of expression. And yet the important thing about folk culture is that it originates within a community of shared convictions. The difference today is I turn on the TV set or I pick up a magazine at the newsstand or turn on the radio or go to the theater. What I'm exposed to there is produced by someone who may be from an entirely different setting, who may have an entirely different set of assumptions. The thing that binds us, that is me as the consumer of this popular culture and the producer of it, is sheerly an economic transaction. That is, I'm paying for an experience. I'm paying for a few moments of diversion. So the person producing that thing, whether it be a television show or a song or a book, is not really concerned with building up the community. They're not really concerned with shaping the character of the members of a particular community, as was the case in folk culture. They're concerned with making money. So the economic interests outweigh what we might call the communal interest, or the concern for the quality of the community. That's in the nature of popular culture. And you know, we often get upset when we hear of people producing things, particularly if they're aimed at kids. And yet, you know, what we need to recognize is that because of the fact that we don't live in a setting where cultural artifacts are communicated to us by people we know and people who have a shared set of convictions, this is almost inevitable that we're going to find things that are objectionable. Now, high culture is a term that's a relatively recent phenomenon in human history. The idea that people would produce art or music very deliberately, not so much to serve a specific community of people, but to serve mankind, as it were, to serve posterity. So you begin to see the rise of art and music and literature that is intended to have a kind of universal appeal, but it's intended to represent truth, goodness, and beauty. It's not there just to make money, although the practitioners of high culture often did for a living. But they were also guided by an assumption that there were truths and there were enduring values, both in beauty and in goodness, that could be represented in those cultural forms. So high culture might be seen as a way of taking the production of culture out of a tight-knit community, a folk, a people, but it's still committed to a set of values, still committed to a set of convictions and beliefs and commitments that assumed that there were some things that were inherently good, some things inherently evil. The problem is, we've had popular culture for a long time, and popular culture and high culture have coexisted for a long time in American life. The difference is that popular culture has now taken over to an extent that has never been the case. When I went to school in the 1960s, it was assumed that a middle-class kid growing up would be exposed to certain cultural forms in music and art and literature that had eternal value, a kind of a permanent quality about them. That's no longer assumed in public schools, and it's often not even assumed in Christian settings, that we ought to be exposed to permanent things through our cultural life. Our cultural life is more just kind of a set of momentary diversions or experiences.
And Ken, I appreciate your analysis of pop culture, because as you describe it, I think we all begin to recognize what you're talking about. It's shallow, it's individualistic, it's narcissistic. I think there's also, if you try to plumb the heart of popular culture, I think you tend to find this state of perpetual rebellion against the previous generations. It's why you get the generation XYZ LMNOP developing over time, because it seems to me that what is happening is you're effectively rebelling against the culture of your fathers and grandfathers, and when as you rebel against high culture, you're rebelling against the fathers that have existed throughout history, the church fathers, whether it be fathers in the City of Man or the City of God, but most definitely you're cutting off from yourself the heritage, the cultural heritage of the past. Isn't that what's happening with pop culture?
That's an insight that I didn't have as firmly when I wrote the book in 1989 as I do now. And the way I describe this now is human culture, which I think is something God gives us. God created us to be social. God created us to live in communities. He created us to have connections with other people. He didn't create us to be individualistic and atomistic. But human cultures historically have been presupposed to be a legacy. There's a sense in which we inherit our culture, that is, a way of life, which includes music and stories and art and all sorts of artifacts and food and all sorts of other things. We inherit a way of life and we pass it on to our children. That was the assumption. Culture was a legacy. Now, culture is viewed as a commodity. A commodity is something that individuals purchase for their own individual purposes. So that most people today don't feel a sense of obligation to pass on to their children the musical inheritance or the literary inheritance or the poetic inheritance that they received. We find people who share those likes and dislikes. And increasingly, we find them on the internet and not in the communities where we live. So culture becomes then, I use the term autoculturalism. You know, we had the term multiculturalism, which described the fact that we live in a society where there are lots of different cultures. Well, I think it's even more severe than that. We live in a society where everyone is a culture of one, with apologies to the army, where everyone kind of constructs their cultural life on their own. Now, again, we're encouraged to do that, and the people who sell us cultural artifacts are more than happy to accommodate that. Now, you talked about the disposing of the past. See, if you basically see culture as something that is constructed for your own benefit, something that makes you feel good rather than something that identifies you as part of a community, well, then there's a great appeal to starting fresh, to starting over. So a lot of cultural forms that are conveyed to us through mass media are very deliberately focused on doing new things.
Yes.
We have a kind of addiction to novelty. Now, the addiction to novelty is there in part because I think popular culture does encourage a kind of restlessness, a kind of restless quest for a new experience. But the addiction to novelty is also there because of the fact that people want to sell us new things. The music industry could not survive if people were content with music that they had,
right.
If they were content with a legacy. Through most of human history, it was assumed that we would have stories and poetry and music that we would pass on to our children. Today, we can't even hope to pass on our television sets to our children because they're not going to receive digital signals. But I think that this idea of the difference between culture as legacy and culture as commodity is really, really important. Now, for Christians in particular, the scriptures present our faith to us as something that we are to pass on to our children. And so it's not just a personal commodity. Christian belief is not just a commodity that I like and I'm indifferent whether or not my kids like it. The Christian faith is something that is meant to be passed on. Part of the problem I think we're facing in this country now is that we've so much given into the idea of culture as commodity that it becomes very difficult for us to see Christianity as something that is shared by communities and shared across generational lines. That's a real challenge.
Ken, I want to bring this back to home and the way we construct our culture and our Christian homes. As I set out to establish a cultural situation for my family, I find that the biblical tests of moderation and edification are good. Now, sometimes it seems like what is edifying may not be enjoyable, and sometimes what is enjoyable may not be edifying. Should our culture, our art forms be edifying or enjoyable or both, and how do they relate to each other?
I think they can be both, because I think that if we presuppose that human nature is something God has made, and that He's made us to delight in things that are fitting for our nature. Now, of course, we're sinful, so we don't always delight in things that are fitting for our nature. Marital fidelity is something that's fitting for our nature as we were created. But because we're sinful, marital fidelity is not always something that people delight in. So part of the task of growing as a redeemed creature, as someone who is on the road to recovering the nature that God originally made for us, part of that task is learning to delight in that which is truly delightful, that which we were made to delight in, that which is good for us, because that which is good for us isn't like, you know, some nasty tasting medicine. That which is good for us is finally that which is most in keeping with the nature that we have. So part of the task of cultural life to figure out those experiences which were both enjoyable and edifying, that is, those which were fitting for for the kind of creatures that we are.
So you want what's edifying and what's enjoyable, but you got to bring those two things together.
And they need to be brought together as the desires are trained. Now, one thing is, let's bring this practically to family life. When we were raising our kids, I've got two kids in college now. One's almost 20 and one's 21.
Okay.
We early on thought that we wanted our kids not to be captive to the tyranny of the fashionable, but we wanted to give them the freedom to like things that really were fun. So we started very early. You know, some parents say, well, we'll just turn off the TV set and have it at that. Well, that might work in some families, but it's pretty hard to keep kids away from television forever. And so we thought, well, let's expose them to some of the best old movies. So we started watching old, now this was easy for me because I knew a lot of old films, having majored in film studies. So they got interested in films from the 30s and 40s and 50s. And not all necessarily safe or uplifting films. Some of them are just kind of just fun. But they recognize the nature of the fun. We expose them to a lot of books. Again, not necessarily obviously uplifting books, but just good literature and some fun literature. Like my kids got interested in the fiction of P.G. Woodhouse, who's a brilliant writer and whose work is not particularly uplifting or edifying in an obvious way, other than the fact that he just uses language in such a delightful way. And I tend to believe that since God gave us language, that any time we use it well, that's a good thing for us. So we tried to expose them to things that were, you know, we didn't just insist that they only listen to Bach and only read fine literature. We exposed them to popular things that were good things. When my daughter was 16, she asked for Christmas for a CD of Ella Fitzgerald. Well, I was thrilled. That's, you know, popular culture, but it's really, really good. I mean, there is a lot of good popular culture. The biggest problem with popular culture is that we become captive to that which is fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
I think we live in a time when parents and churches, Christian communities, have the capacity, because of TiVo and the ability to buy DVDs, we have the capacity to kind of choose those popular cultural forms. We're not captive to network television as earlier generations were. We can choose those cultural experiences which are most fitting for our community, for our way of life, for our convictions, and our kids can be exposed to those. Now, again, I think that it's hard to do that just within one family. That's why I think this is something that communities of Christians and local churches need to attend to.
No question about it. Folks, today, an absolutely critical analysis of culture today on Generations. And Ken, we appreciate you joining us today on Generations. And folks can get more information on your ministry efforts at MarsHillAudio.org. Great comments from a man who's written a significant book. My friends, I encourage you to be more discerning. Certainly, mothers and fathers need to be discerning. Otherwise, their children, their families will be eaten alive by the culture. That's why I recommend Ken's book, All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes, Christians and Popular Culture. You can get the book by going to kevinswanson.com and click on store. We've got a lot of worldview resources there for you. You can interact with the program, my friends, by emailing me at host@kevinswanson.com. And you can hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world, at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we lay down a vision for the next generation.